He's not on, there we go.
Joint Committee on Public Safety, come to order, May 29, 2013. Committee, welcome back.
Thanks.
We are here tonight to discuss an amendment to House Bill 3194. I'm going to ask committee counsel to walk us through the amendment in detail after I say a couple things in terms of an overview. We're here to discuss what is really a compromise package, a balanced package of sentencing and corrections reforms that meets the goal that we all share of protecting public safety, flatlining our prison growth so that we can save taxpayers over $500 million in avoided costs over the next decade if no changes are made, and continue holding offenders accountable while reserving prison beds for those who most need to be in prison. The bill includes 17 out of the 19 policy options that the Governor's Commission on Public Safety recommended, as well as some other components that are in keeping with the Commission's strategy to focus prison beds on serious violent offenders and provide community corrections agencies with the resources and the authority they need to reduce recidivism and cut crime. If passed and signed into law, this legislation will flatline our prison growth, averting the need for over 2,000 additional prison beds over the next decade, and the roughly $600 million that would be associated with that growth in terms of additional operational and construction expenses. Most importantly, this legislation will allow us to target our funding on local public safety infrastructure that in recent biennia has suffered dramatic underfunding. And we all know that in some of our counties in Oregon that are particularly distressed, this need is achieving a crisis point. The bill, the amendment we're going to hear, removes the two policy options addressing Measure 11 offenses, both dealing with adult and juvenile offenders. Much data and evidence, as well as public and some legislative support for making modest modifications to Measure 11, but not consensus, and there are questions that remain about how that modification should take shape. So I believe that continued work on Measure 11 changes is appropriate, especially pertaining to juveniles, but those changes are not part of the package before us tonight. This amendment represents 2 years of work by the Governor's Commission, 4 months of work by this committee, and significant dialogue with stakeholder groups over the last several months. We're asking for your support in this important opportunity to make our state safer at a lower cost to Oregonians. I'm going to ask Committee Counsel Josh Nasby to begin to take us through the amendment in detail. Much of it is familiar to members of the committee who have been involved in discussions up through tonight, but it's time to walk through this formally as a group and to present to the public. And following that, we're going to have invited testimony on a specific issue that may or may not end up in the final amendment. We're dealing with a case known as Buchholz, and we've asked Judge Collins, Mr. Gardner from Lane County, and Mr. Matazar to brief the committee on their different perspectives on that issue. So we will hear from them after Mr. Nasby walks us through the amendment, starting now. Any questions before we start?
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. There are two amendments that were released today. They're substantially similar. I'm going to walk you through the dash sevens, and at the conclusion of that, I'm going to identify two differences between the sevens and the eights. But everything I say about the sevens is also true about the eights, so I'll work through that first. Feel free to interrupt with questions or concerns as we move through the process. So two sort of big picture points worth making. I think Co-Chair Garrett may have just made them, but I'm going to hit them again. Number one is there are no Measure 11 changes in the bill. And number two, in terms of sentencing date, the vast majority of the sentencing changes in the measure apply to sentences imposed on or after July 1. So it's prospective beginning July 1. There's one exception to that general rule, and that is earned time. That amendment will apply to crimes committed on or after July 1, 2013. So those are sort of big picture. Moving through the substance of the amendments, the Measure 57 changes in Sections 1 and 2 are identical to the Measure 57 changes in the printed bill. Briefly, what they do is on the property side, they establish a presumptive range of prison months as opposed to a presumptive sentence. The months can be, the range is between 19 and 24 months and 13 and 18 respectively. The drug component of Measure 57 eliminates mandatory minimums for multiple offenders. And again, those two changes remain the same as in the printed bill. Moving to Section 4, the marijuana offenses, it's substantially similar to the printed bill. There was one minor change, and that ensured that we didn't increase sentences on the possession of less than 150 grams. So under the new amendment, the possession of 150 grams remains a level one on the guidelines. Everything above 150 is subject to the sort of federal weights that we've described at earlier hearings. Moving along to the driving while suspended or revoked, that is identical to the printed bill. There are no changes. The transitional leave is substantially similar to the printed bill, very minor sort of wordsmithing. The earned time provision, however, is different. As you all may know, on July 1 of this year, earned time is scheduled to sunset to 20%. Current law today authorizes a subset of inmates to receive 30%. So the earned time changes kick in July 1, 2013 to crimes committed on or after that date. They authorize the Department of Corrections to grant an additional 10% reduction in the term of incarceration in the total of the eligible terms of incarceration. But this additional 10% has additional requirements. So they're not identical requirements in terms of whether the inmate can earn the 20% and the additional 10%. The specific requirements are in the bill. I just point you to pages 18 and 19. You'll see those requirements. Moving along to the alternative incarceration program, this is a different amendment than was in the printed bill. The amendment in the alternative incarceration program section authorizes the Department of Corrections to apply the 20% reduction for participation in the program to each eligible sentence that the offender's been sentenced to. And so the sort of big picture is AIP and earned time will now be applied consistently to each eligible sentence and not to ineligible sentences. The probation provisions in the amendment are, with one exception, identical to what's in the printed bill. So the structured sanctions components that we've talked about and the conditions of probation remain the same. A new concept in the Dash 7s is a limit on the length of a revocation sanction that the court can impose for a technical, and that is used to mean a non-criminal conviction. So it limits the length of revocation sanctions for technical violations of probation. There are two different limits. If the sentence of probation was imposed as a presumptive sentence, the limit is 60 days. And this is a practice that's been in place for 4 years that will continue going forward. If, however, the probation sentence was imposed as a downward dispositional departure, the limit is 180 days for a technical violation unless the court finds substantial and compelling reasons to impose a longer sentence. If the court makes that finding, it can impose a sentence up to 13 months for a technical violation. So moving along, the earned discharge provisions is substantively the same. There was some wordsmithing done, but it's substantively the same as in the printed bill. One thing worth noting is the language in the baseline has again changed, but the point of the language in the baseline is to prevent counties from being penalized for granting earned discharge. So I think that's important to get on the record. Related to that, the baseline change, and I'm looking on page 44 for those of you following along, the baseline change also prohibits the baseline from being increased as a result of programs that are funded under this bill. So the goal with the baseline provision is to ensure that this bill does not upset the way it works now. So I'm going to hit a number of things all at once. The task force to review this measure, the statewide definition of recidivism, the specialty courts provisions, the correctional forecast provisions, the program evaluation, the fiscal impact statements, and the DOC cost per day provisions remain substantially similar to what was in the printed bill. The grant program, I'm looking at starting on page 54, was modified in a number of ways, but I do think it's fair to say it retains its essential character as in the printed bill. I want to draw your attention to pages 57 and 58. You'll see there's a definition of community-based programs, and I just want to make clear that this is a non-exclusive list of options that a county can employ for purposes of the grant program. And then finally, brand new to the bill is the creation of the Oregon Center for Policing Excellence in the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. So that sort of, in a very quick nutshell, is the Dash 7 amendments. The two differences between the 7s and the 8s, the first involves probation revocations, the technical violation caps that we just described. The Dash 8 does not contain the 13-month, what we've referred to as escape clause. Instead, it's a hard cap of 180 days for technical violations of probation. So that's one difference between the Dash 7 and the Dash 8. The second difference involves the testimony you're about to hear surrounding State v. Buchholz and the manner in which criminal history is calculated. And rather than waste your time by me trying to explain it, I will turn it back over to the chair so you can have the folks on the ground give you a better explanation of the Buchholz issue.
Before we get to that, I think I'd like to ask the other co-chairs if they want to say anything and then take any questions or discussion from committee members about what we've just heard. So throw it open. Okay. Representative Barker.
I want to understand. So somebody takes it a downward departure and then they do a technical violation. And the downward departure is from presumptive prison. So under the 7, a judge can go above the 13 months.
Co-chairs Representative Barker, the judge can get to 13 months.
Get to 13, okay.
In the Dash 8, it's a hard cap of 180 days.
Yeah, okay. Can go from 180 to 13.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else? Representative Hicks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So could we go to page 21, lines 4 and 5, AIP? Mm-hmm. And could counsel describe the nature of that change to the law, please?
To
that change to the law? Or is it a change to the law? What exactly is that?
Co-chairs, Representative Hicks, members of the committee. So as I indicated, what this language does is it says to the Department of Corrections, you are authorized to grant an offender a 20% reduction in each eligible sentence for successful completion of the alternative incarceration program. I think I would take the position that this is not, in fact, a change in the law. But my understanding is the Department of Corrections has interpreted the current language differently, so I don't want you to be under the mistaken impression that this won't change facts on the ground. I believe it will, but I don't believe it to be a change in the law. I think when the Assembly in 2008 imposed the 20% limit on AIP, they intended for that to mirror the way earned time is applied. So this language, the amendments here and in the earned time section is identical, so that when an offender has two or three eligible sentences, the 20% reduction applies to each of the eligible sentences.
Clarification, in other words, of the statute.
Co-Chair Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee, I believe this to be a clarification, but again, I don't want you under the misimpression that this doesn't do anything. I think it will impact the Department of Corrections behavior.
Right.
And follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So page 44, line 21. Chance to get there. So we're okay. 44. Oh, I think I got the wrong. Hmm. I'm sorry. Okay, let me ask a different question. So probation, we've talked a lot about technical violations on probation. What about on PPS, however? We don't seem to address technical violations on PPS.
Co-Chairs, Representative Hicks, members of the committee, that's correct. The technical violations is a probation issue.
Strictly probation, so persons on post-prison supervision, the amendment does not in any way address what happens to technical violations on post-prison supervision?
That's correct.
Thank you. So also, actually, if I may, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you. So let's see, Section 43, I think it's page 58.
43?
Yeah. Yeah, Section 43, and it would be page 58. There it is. That's line 21 on page 58. What is this?
Co-Chairs, Representative Hicks, members of the committee. This was in the printed bill, and it's structured a little bit differently as a component of the grant program, but as I indicated, the grant program lists a non-exclusive number of programs that the counties can apply for to receive performance incentive funding. One of those programs is a voluntary program, just so we're clear. One of those programs is the county can choose to supervise offenders sentenced to 15 months or less. That's a change in the law. Under current law, counties are responsible for folks who get 12 years or less in the
12
state.
12 months.
Thank you. 12 months or less. Offenders who get 12 months or less in the state, 12 months in a day is a state responsibility. What this amendment does is if the county chooses to supervise folks sentenced to 15 months or less, there's a process by which they could obtain a grant, notify the court, and once that's up and running, the general rule that offenders sentenced to between 12 and 15 months would normally go to DOC is changed in this amendment. I hope that makes sense. If not, please.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, it seems that within the context of the bill, I mean, a sentence that would have been under Measure 57, presumptive prison, a 13-month sentence would potentially at the county's discretion be post-conviction a non-presumptive prison sentence anymore because it's 13 months.
Co-chairs, Representative Hicks, members of the committee, I think that's right. I think the Measure 57 changes have a range, so it's the 13 to 18. So the range would have to be less than the sentence imposed would have to be less than 15, and it would have to be in a participating county that has chosen to supervise these folks. But I think you're absolutely right.
Thank you.
No further discussion? Yeah, well, thank you. So with that, why don't we invite Judge Collins to come up and start us off on a discussion of the Miller-Buchholz issue. And welcome.
Yes, thank
Thanks
you.
Thanks for being here. And
co-chairs and
If we're going to have a Q&A, I think it would be better
actually, that's
that
a great idea. Mr. Gardner and Mr. Matizar, would you also come forward? Welcome, Mr.
Ready? Okay. Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is John Collins. I'm the presiding judge in Yamhill County, and I was the trial judge representative on the Commission for Public Safety. I should start off by saying I don't speak today for the judicial branch nor for the Public Safety Commission. I have been a judge, though, for over 20 years. I was district attorney for 17 years before that. I've been a community corrections manager when the concept was new in the 70s. And very briefly served as a criminal defense attorney. I bring that history up largely to point out that I've been in the system well before sentencing guidelines and before all the mandatory minimums that I may be referring to here today. I want to thank you for the invitation to speak before the committee regarding what has sometimes been referred to as the Miller-Buchholz fix. Named after two back-to-back Supreme Court decisions in the relatively early days of sentencing guidelines, 1993. I welcome the opportunity to address the issue from a judicial perspective. I also welcome the opportunity as a member of the Public Safety Commission. The Commission discussed this issue both in terms of justice and in terms of impact of the rule on prison population, so we did not have any data or statistics like we did in most of the decisions that were before the commission. However, because we did not have that data-driven numbers, we had in other areas, and because the issue is recognized as somewhat complex, the commission did elect to identify the issue as one that the legislature should look at, and you are, but too complex to be addressed within the commission's timeline. The proposed amendments, I believe, capture the issue, though they go beyond the Miller-Buchholz effect on sentencing guidelines cases to how prior convictions are counted in other sentencing provisions. To me, it makes sense to address both important areas because the underlying concept and the issue is the same. As I understand, the relevant portions of the amendments will address, one, sentencing guidelines criminal history score as affected by the Miller-Buchholz decision. That's in Section 4. Measure 57, repeat property offenses and repeat drug delivery and manufacture offenses. That's in Section 1 and also in some of the other sections. Aggravated identity theft is referred to in Section 1. And there's something called unlawful credit card factoring, whatever that is referred to in the bill. Guess I'll know one when I see one. There are other sentencing provisions elevated by prior convictions that are not affected by this bill. To aid in this testimony, I have provided the panel with two bench guides, one on mandatory minimum sentences, including Measure 11. That's this one. Some of you will have it in color, some in black and white. Judicial budget ran out, so some of you got the black and whites. The other one is on Measure 57 property offenses, and in this chart, you'll notice on these two boxes, which are the two categories, one of them being 24-month crime, the other being 18-month crimes, you'll see right down at the bottom of the box where I added amendment, range 19 to 24 months instead of 24 months. In the box below, it's a range 13 to 18 instead of 18. And then the other big change is the one that is highlighted about halfway down the page, and that is that a prior conviction means a conviction that occurred prior to the crime that's before the court for sentencing. And in many ways, that's the Buchholz concept. I don't have one on the Measure 57 drug delivery factors. I guess I need to do that, but that would probably be similar to the one that was on the Measure 57 property offenses. These other provisions are significant for how the ones I'm about to mention, for how they, in one way or another, address the issue already and would not be affected by House Bill 3195. First one I have is Measure 73 regarding, quote, major felony sex crimes that result in a 25-year minimum term. That would that provision maintains the definition of previous conviction to include a conviction in the same sentencing proceeding if the conviction is for a separate criminal episode. This was built into the measure by the drafters. It's essentially the law as it is now after Miller-Buchholz in regard to sentencing guidelines. Because it was a ballot measure, it would take the dreaded two-thirds vote, I suppose, to change that, and I'm not suggesting that you should. Second provision is the Three Strikes Law, ORS 137.719. This provides for life without release or parole for a third or subsequent felony sex crime. The judge may downward depart under criteria provided in the statute. The sentences for more than two convictions in the same sentencing proceeding count as one sentence. So in a sense, this might be Buchholz but not Miller. Miller but not Buchholz. Miller was one indictment and Buchholz was two of them brought together. I'm not sure it makes a lot of difference, but the point is that this issue is already addressed in current law in ORS 137.719. And again, I'm not suggesting that that needs to be changed. The third one is a particularly interesting one, and that's the so-called Denny Smith determinative sentence provision, ORS 137.635. That provides that a person will serve out the entire term without credits, without early release, without eligibility for alternative incarceration programs. In other words, whatever the sentence is, that's the sentence they serve, no reductions. And that has to do with people who commit certain serious crimes. Burglary is one that comes to mind, robbery another one that comes to mind, and they have a prior offense of the same nature. In this, the measure did not speak to this issue. It did not define whether that prior conviction had to have occurred prior to the crime itself. But the Supreme Court, or the Court of Appeals, in a case called State versus Allison in 1996, addressed the issue. And I think in that sense, their job, because that was a measure, voted upon measure, not a legislative enactment, their job was to discern the will or intent of the voters as opposed to the will or intent of the legislature. There's much discussion in that Allison decision regarding so-called habitual offender statutes to which this measure was compared and how they usually only count convictions that occurred prior to the crime itself. And that's, again, the change that would be made by the provisions in 3194. The intent of this, I believe, is, and that's what they determined was the intent of the voters in that measure. So the crime has to have occurred prior to conviction, prior to the crime for which the person is before the court. The intent of this, I believe, is to punish harder and isolate longer those persons who have committed a crime, been sentenced on it, and then go out and do it again. Another provision that addresses this issue is Measure 73, which is that portion of it that deals with the repeat DUII offender. The statute only counts prior DUIIs that occurred prior to the present DUII and within the last 10 years. Or if it's a prior felony DUII, then it doesn't matter if it's within the last 10 years. But that has to have been committed before the crime, the present DUII, was committed, much like what's proposed in the amendments. The last one is one that's been around probably the longest of all these. I had to double check whether this was, I was here before even it, but it came in the late 70s. This is the firearms minimum under ORS 161.610. There, it provides that a person will serve a minimum five-year term for the commission of a felony with a firearm. But there are also enhancement provisions in that statute. A second conviction after being convicted of a firearms felony, in other words, the crime committed after the conviction on a prior firearms felony conviction, again, the model that the amendments would follow, results in a 10-year sentence. And if there is even a third one after that, both in sequential, in other words, it's the example I'll give later where a person commits a crime, they're sentenced, they're back out, they commit another crime, they're sentenced, they're back out, they commit a third crime. Then that elevates to a 30-year minimum sentence. Again, in each case, the prior firearms minimum conviction must have occurred prior to the crime itself. The central issue, as I see it, is how are prior convictions to be counted? In defining repeat and Measure 57 crimes and in sentencing guidelines as they are counted in the defendant's criminal history score.
Judge, just to clarify, the pieces you just went over, those are your references to things that would not be changed right. by the bill in front of us. And now you're turning to what we're actually potentially changing with if we take up the Buchholz issue. Is that right?
That's true, and okay. I brought it up for another reason, to show that policymakers, whether it's the voters or the legislature, have addressed this before, and it's usually along the lines that is being proposed in the amendments. Not always, but okay. usually. The central issues is how are prior convictions are to be counted. The questions would be, should prior offenses be counted only if the conviction occurred prior to the present crime? Currently, a person who commits three felonies, separate criminal episodes, is then before the court for sentencing, is treated the same as a person who commits a crime, serves time, or goes through probation, then commits a second felony, serves time, or goes through probation, and then commits a third felony. Both of these are subject to the same sentencing provisions. Another question would be, should the multiplier effect of present law add significantly to the number of persons sentenced to imprisonment and or the length of stay? And I'm sure that it does. Len Engel from the Pew organization advises me that they estimate this would have about a 200-bed impact in terms of a reduction, essentially, if the amendments were adopted. A third bullet might be, should the sentence with regard to one victim be considerably less than what it is regarding another victim solely because the second victim was later in time or sequence of charging. Both victims are impacted. And then I wrote, to what extent is Miller-Buchholz as regards sentencing guidelines not the intent of the legislature that enacted the guidelines, or, if it was, should it continue to be so? As I indicated earlier, I was around when sentencing guidelines were enacted, and it is my personal view that I don't think the legislature intended what the Supreme Court version of Miller-Buchholz came to. I think they intended what the Court of Appeals version of the case came to that was reversed at the Supreme Court. The basic premise is this: should a person who commits three crimes in three separate criminal episodes and is before the court for those cases be treated the same as a person who commits a crime, is convicted, serves probation, incarceration, and commits another such crime, and then repeats again? It appears to me that the effects of the amendments would be to provide for a near consistent state policy, consistent with the other provisions that I've mentioned that would not be affected by the provision. I say near consistent because there are some provisions that I've mentioned that are essentially have Miller-Buchholz-like rules in it already. It would likely reduce prison commitments on some early offenders with a chance, most would say a better chance, in a community corrections local jail setting with greater access to treatment or programs and still maintain accountability. Again, Mr. Engel suggests 200 beds. And third, it will differentiate between the offender who was sentenced, had a chance to reform, and yet thereafter committed another crime from the person who commits more than one crime before getting caught. Judges normally don't take positions on policy. That's for the legislature. But this is one of those areas of the law reform that judges are allowed and, in fact, should speak up on. It affects the core of what judges do at sentencing, to do justice based on principles of accountability, public safety, and possible reformation. I believe the amendments are good public policy, will save prison costs, free up funds for more effective local corrections options, and promote more just and proportional outcomes in many cases. I thank you for your time, and I don't know if you want to take the others first, but I'll respond as you see fit.
I think it'll make more sense if we hear from Mr. Gardner and then Mr. Matizar, and then we can have a full exchange of questions and answers. So if you're ready.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Alex Gardner, and I'm the district attorney in Lane County. I don't know how many of you have read the Buchholz decision, but it starts out as a sort of technical analysis of what the what the language requires and what the legislature intended. It was a technical analysis that drove the decision, but the decision that we ended up with is a common sense definition, which basically says that a person who has a history of bad prior conduct ought to be credited with that bad conduct when the sentencing decision is made. Judge Ellis spoke during that process, and this is a quote. He said, "But in actual practice, it seems to me you are trying to figure out what to do with the individual at the time you sentence him. And it seems to me you ought to consider everything that has occurred up to the time you sentence him." That notion that a person's prior conduct ought to shape the evaluation of the punishment is commonsensical. It's what the community expects. Further on, the judge, and I'm reading directly from the Buchholz opinion, the judge made it clear that he wished to consider at sentencing, quote, any conviction that falls between the date of the present crime and the sentencing for the present crime. And the Supreme Court opinion notes that's consistent with this opinion. Basically, the difference between Buchholz and what is contemplated by the current amendment is whether the conviction has to actually be entered before it has any impact. So this is of tremendous importance in Lane County. And what the Supreme Court position, with the rule the Supreme Court gave us in Buchholz is basically the same rule we see applied in other aspects of sentencing. So, for example, when the court is evaluating whether or not a upward or downward departure is appropriate, the court will entertain any evidence of the defendant's conduct up to that point, including conduct between the act that for which the defendant is being sentenced and the day of sentencing, even if it's been 6, 8 months or a couple of years. It's the whole package of the defendant that is relevant. those things are not weighed, those prior acts and conduct is not weighed with the same, or not given the same weight that a conviction is, because a conviction has to be established beyond a reasonable doubt. It seems to us, those who are doing this work on a daily basis, that it doesn't make sense to sort of depreciate the criminal history because of the timing of the entry of judgment. In other words, what matters is this the guy and is this the conduct that he engaged in, and did that conduct precede this act for which he is being sentenced? When that order was entered that acknowledges that shouldn't be relevant to the process. A few moments ago, Judge Collins asked, does it make sense that victims of the same defendant, the defendant should be punished differently for essentially the same crime against a series of victims just because of the order in which that conduct fell? Victim A the defendant should be punished less for the rape of victim A because it came before the rape of victim B, and so on. But that's the way the system has always been designed. My question I would ask you is it significant that he was sentenced between victim A and the rape of victim A and the rape of victim B? That's a distinction that would be meaningless to those victims and, frankly, to the people that we talk to about this in the community. We expect somebody to be punished more severely if they've engaged in the same conduct repeatedly. I want to just mention briefly how things work or frankly don't work in Lane County. It's very common for us to have people fail to appear 5 or 6 or 7 times. So we have lots of people that we can't get sentenced on crime number 3 because they just don't show up. And this, if this law was amended to make not the timing of the offense, but the timing of the sentencing on the offense the critical turning point, it would add an incentive, an additional incentive, which we surely don't need in Lane County for these guys to fail to appear. It would basically reward those who just skip court. And I know some of you know that we were fortunate enough to pass a 55-cent levy in Lane County. It's fantastic news. But for context, once that money is flowing and we're able to hire, that will bring Lane County's corrections capacity up to 1/3 of the Oregon average on a per 1,000 crimes basis. So we're still going to be completely dysfunctional for the vast majority of property offenders. They're going to continue to be bounced on burg ones and car thefts at roughly the same rate that they're bounced now. We won't be able to get those people to sentencing, and there are many jurisdictions in Oregon that are approaching similar financial extremis. And I recognize the financial incentives that are present in this package. Frankly, in Lane County, we'll be grateful for any help we can get. But I always want to put the extent of the need in perspective. As I understand it, if 3194 passes in its present form, and if Lane County elects to participate as fully as we can, it amounts to something on the order of $3.4 million per biennium. And we could do something great with that, I'm sure. But if we had the Marion County tax rate, it would be upwards of $90 million more per biennium. If we had the Multnomah County tax rate, it's on the order of $180 million more per biennium. So I mention that just to underscore that $3.4 million, while it will be some help, it is not going to provide the community correction structure that we need to make any of this work. These guys are basically that we get back in our community because of flexing the correction structure are going to be a disaster for us that we can't manage. And with our failure to appear rate, Miller-Buchholz is an essential, perhaps the most essential toolkit we have in Lane County. It means that when we finally get these guys, it might be 3 or 4 years downstream. We've got the convictions entered, but we haven't been able to sentence them. When we finally get them, and the way we get them invariably is because they commit another crime and they're arrested in pursuit following that, then we can get rid of them. I can't underscore it enough. We desperately need Miller-Buchholz to remain intact. Thank you.
Mr. Mazur.
I'm Larry members of the committee, sorry, co-chairs.
Larry, could you move the microphone closer to me?
I'm Larry Matasar. I was a member of the commission, and I mostly defend criminal cases. Although I've had a number of other cases over the years, I've been retained by the Judicial Department to represent judges. I've done some election law cases. I've had a wide variety of cases. I represent lawyers before the bar and doctors accused of various kinds of misconduct. I really only have two main points I want to make. One is about the general Buchholz issue. Judge Collins talked about it, and I know we've all seen the guidelines grid, but in Oregon we have simply two ways that people, two factors that are considered in the sentence. One is the seriousness of the crime, the other is the history of the individual. And what we try to do is use those factors to create a box to put somebody in and determine what their sentence should be. It's true that under this, so the essential question about Buchholz, and it seems to me, while I have not run any numbers about failure to appear, it seems like that is, this is a giant, what do they say, using a blunderbuss to shoot a bee, something like that. This is a huge way to affect the failure to appear issue by making 200 additional beds over a 10-year period. But what Buchholz is about, what this issue is about, is the person who commits four burglaries in one night versus the person who commits four burglaries. Now, let me say, each victim of those four burglaries doesn't really care, and we have to be honest about this from the defense side. If you're a victim of a burglary, it doesn't matter if you're the perpetrator did four in one night or did the first one. Maybe you're not the first one when the guy gets probation. The second one, when he gets maybe 60 days in jail and a drug program and he doesn't pass that. Third one, when he gets a year county time and a more serious drug program, or the fourth one. However, much of the whole focus of punishment as we see it in our courts all the time is that the person who has failed repeatedly is a recidivist, is somebody who deserves worse punishment than somebody who has not, than somebody who has not had the opportunity to have the drug program and that sort of thing. The other thing I wanted to say, the main thing I wanted to say, and I was going to say more about that, but Judge Collins really covered it, is in from my time on the commission, I know that there are certain things that legislators are asked to do which are sort of messing with a much more serious and grounded principle than others. For example, Measure 11 was voted on by the voters twice, passed in the legislature. That's a issue that is very firmly rooted, if you will, in the Oregon state of mind. But Buchholz, for goodness sakes, this is a Supreme Court analysis of an Oregon administrative rule. This is, as Judge Collins said, sounds like he would have dissented from the Supreme Court view. It was not a principle that was passed by the legislature that said every single time somebody commits a crime, even if they're standing there, you know, the defendant is standing in sentencing, and the judge will say, okay, Mr. Smith, you're a, on the first crime of your four burglaries, say, you're a I, so you fall within the 90 to 180. Then on the second one, you're really not an I, you might be an H. On the third one, you're an E, so you get much more time. The legislature, that was not a main focus. This is an Oregon administrative rule, which was a close question.
the Court of Appeals, in a unanimous decision by the panel of the Court of Appeals, what they said was, the legislative history demonstrates a legislative intent that convictions sentenced at the same time are present convictions that are not counted in the criminal history. So the three members of the, now I know it's not the law, and if I were making this argument to a circuit court judge, well, I wouldn't make this argument to a circuit court judge, because the law is the law. The Supreme Court makes the law. However, what the Supreme Court is doing is interpreting your words. So you are in a completely different context than a circuit court judge, and you can decide that it makes more sense not to treat a recidivist different than somebody who is not. I also should say that the common sense approach of Buchholz, which the district attorney points out, has some limitations. First of all, the federal guidelines do not adopt that approach. I'm told that the majority of state courts that have guidelines do not adopt the Buchholz approach. And also, in the day-to-day experience in the criminal courts, we see many, many, many times when people are not charged with everything they've done. Prosecutors do not charge every crime. You have somebody who has maybe committed several burglaries or armed robberies or whatever it is, or thefts from shoplifting, whatever the crimes are, it is routine that people are not charged with every single thing they have done wrong. And the system is able to deal with through departures. Of course, everybody doesn't get the box. Some people who've done a much worse thing than is in the box or have a better background or whatever get a departure either up or down. The system, the circuit court judges are able to figure out who deserves more punishment, who deserves less punishment. All this thing does, all this amendment does, is not increase in every single case somebody's expected sentence. So that's why it makes sense to me.
Co-chairs, could I address another issue?
Please.
And members of the committee, I wanted to respond to what was indicated by the district attorney who...
Mr. Collins, could you move the microphone closer to you, please?
Sounds like the courts lack any authority to punish somebody more severely or to take a more serious sentence with someone who commits more than one crime. That's simply not the case. There's ample authority for courts to do that in any sentencing. That ability exists through considering the fact that multiple crimes have been committed as an aggravating factor recognized under the guidelines that could support an upward departure. Even more significantly, though, is the authority of courts have to impose consecutive sentences. Under current law, I'll give you an example. If a person's before the court, I'm just using these numbers as to illustrate, they're not true numbers, but on the first crime, they might receive a two-year sentence. Under Miller-Buchholz, on the second crime, they would receive a three-year sentence. And on the third crime, they would receive a four-year sentence. Again, I'm just using the numbers as illustration, but you can see how each offense multiplies the one before it because the first offense becomes a prior conviction for the second, and the first and second become a prior for the third. So this person just received 9 years. Under what I think was the legislature's original intent with regard to sentencing guidelines and would be the effect if you adopt the amendments, they could receive 2 years, 2 years, and 2 years on each one of the offenses, assuming they're comparable offenses. So in that case, the person receives 6 years. So there you see, there's a cost savings of 3 years bedtime. Not that that ought to be the only reason, but it's a factor. It allows the court to differentiate between a person who is a true recidivist, committed a crime after they've been convicted of something like it before, and those who commit multiple crimes before they get caught. On the failure to appear problem, let's say the person is facing a crime for which they would receive a two-year sentence. They fail to appear twice. We'll use Lane County, where it would probably be four times. For each one of those, you could add one to that. So you'd have for the one who fails to appear twice, you'd have 2 + 1 + 1. Now they're looking at a four-year sentence because they failed to appear twice. Now, I know those numbers, again, are not true numbers, but they illustrate how, through the process of consecutive sentencing, the court does have plenty of authority to increase the crime and show a disincentive for people to fail to appear. And that argument is even true with regard to crimes that occur out of the same criminal episode, not to get too complicated. The court can even do that, but it does require some specific findings where it's not out of the same criminal episode. And in sentencing guidelines cases, not Measure 57 cases, another rule called shift to I might take effect, which would lower the numbers that could be added. But as to crimes that are not a part of the same criminal episode, which is what we're really talking about here, the court has plenty of authority to impose and isolate and protect the community longer from the repeat offender in the manner that these amendments would allow.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. Co-chairs and members of the committee, and with complete respect for the judge, the fact is the judge also has the discretion in the example that Judge Collins provided to run all the sentences concurrently. There's only one very narrow subset of cases for which that isn't true. But, for example, in the 2 + 3 + 4 case, Judge Collins describes that as a 9-year sentence expectation, and without making findings, the judge can sentence that individual to 4 years, with the narrow exception of people who are in custody at the time they do the offense. There's a great amount of latitude. There are also other brackets that limit the judicial discretion, including 200% and 400% rules. Basically, as under the existing structure with Buchholz, as it's interpreted today, the judge has a wider sentencing window. The other thing that I just wanted to address is that Mr. Matizar's example of the 4 burglaries in one night isn't the common example in my experience. The more common example where Buchholz has a lot of impact is the guy who does 2 dozen identity thefts or 6 or 8 burglaries over a course of 18 months. Then we get him into custody. In Buchholz, that case involved somebody who committed 2 crimes 38 days apart. We're not talking about the same criminal episode, the same course of uninterrupted conduct. We're talking about crimes that might be a year apart, frequently are a year or more apart. Thank you.
Agreed. May I add another comment?
Sure.
The example he gave that changed my number 9 into a number 4 is what's called the 200% rule. That means that the total overall sentence with consecutives can't be twice what the maximum was on the first, more than twice what it was on the first one. There's another rule called the 400% rule, where if you depart upward, then it can't be 400% more than what the original guideline sentence would have been. But the important point I want to make is that neither of those rules, by case law, and it's referred to in one of the bench guides that I gave you, neither of those rules apply to Measure 57 offenses, which is probably the most important, the category of crimes in this bill with the most significant public safety implications. So the court, without even giving a reason, although I think it's good practice to give one, could give the 9 years I gave in my example. Or the judge could combine that. You don't have to be one or the other. You can make it partially consecutive and partially concurrent. But the total could be up to 9 years in the example I gave in almost every case where the crimes don't arise out of the same criminal episode, and that's especially true if it's a Measure 57 offense.
And I agree. To be clear, I agree with what the judge said, but I'm saying the court today has the discretion to make it only 4 years. It still distills to judicial discretion. If the court thinks 4 years is adequate, that'll be the sentence.
Only on a guidelines case. Doesn't apply to Measure 57.
Okay. Do we have questions? I have a question for Mr. Garner. So, just if we were just having this discussion in a vacuum, I can see policy arguments on either side. As you put it, people think all the conduct that occurred should be considered, but it also seems to me that I think it's equally common sense that a person who's gone through the system and had multiple opportunities to rehabilitate and
fails, I think people view that person differently from someone who has not gone through the system. But so I can see both of those arguments. But what I'm stuck on is it seems like we don't have a clear expression of a legislative intent that this is how the law should work. And from what I've, from the other testimony we've heard, this is not a principle that's embraced by the federal system or many other states. So that is at least suggestive that it's, there's a, you know, we should be open to reconsidering whether that's really how we want our system to work. So please go ahead.
Co-Chair Garrett, members of the committee, I can't disagree with any of that. I can't say that there aren't arguments on both sides. We are very different from the federal sentencing structure. All of this is a balancing of community risk. My position is, in this case, I want the sentencing judge to have the a hammer that's big enough to protect the community without restrictions and limitations, as long as it's within the contemplated range. And that's what we're seeing under Buchholz. This has been the standard in Oregon for more than 20 years. And frankly, from my perspective, it's worked very well. What my analysis at this point is, what's going to be different in Lane County if it goes away tomorrow? And the answer is, holy cow. I'm not a Chicken Little running around, you know, skies falling kind of guy. I'm really not. Lane County has been a combat zone for law enforcement for a long time. And we've put together all kinds of sort of cobbled together ways to make the system work when it's really fundamentally dysfunctional. We don't have the local jail capacity to make many of what I advocate for are superior systems. I advocate for many of the alternatives. I believe in them. They don't work if you have no POs and no corrections capacity. Our only tool for dealing with these people, and I can answer one question that was raised earlier about our failure to appear rate, it bounces up over 30% periodically. That's completely unmanageable, and if you want a judicial assessment of that, I encourage any of you to ask our presiding judge or any of the judges you know in Lane County. It's a disaster. The way we have managed to limp along is by having the tools to identify the most vigorous, recalcitrant, unrepentant property criminals in particular and excise them from our community. It's not what I would choose to do. Many of these people probably could be rehabilitated if we had the structure necessary to do it, but we don't, and we're not going to get it. And $3.4 million isn't even going to come close. So what this will do is mean that these folks, these recalcitrant repeat property criminals, just hang out in Lane County and victimize the people longer, because we won't be able to get them to prison for the sentences that we currently see.
Mr. Gardner's comments is exactly why I think the commission, exactly why the commission happened, that they've got insufficient POs, insufficient resources. So the only thing that there is to do is lock people up. And I think that while the commission's goals and such are, and the finances available, are not going to solve Lane County's problems, and that's a shame. But it does pose the exact problem that the commission is designed to deal with. And so it just struck me. I just hope that we could start moving toward a direction less in the just locking people up and more toward the treatment and help, even if it's only $3 million instead of the $180 that they should have. And it seems like a pleasant place to me. It doesn't seem like a combat zone whenever I go there. But anyway.
Representative Garrett, Senator Winters, could I make two more final points?
Please.
First of all, I really have a lot of sympathy for the situation in Lane County. Hopefully their bond measure will help them address some of that. But the problems that are described in Lane County don't seem to me to be the same problems that was elsewhere. A lot of their problems are caused by lack of jail beds. It's not the prison beds issue, it's the local jail beds issue. It also forces Lane County to commit a lot more people to the state because they have no place to keep them on a local basis. So that's a part of it. This whole scheme and the work of the commission is meant to tone down the costs of the state prisons so that resources can go to the locals, so they will have more resources. And with Lane County's bond levy, that'll help with the jail issue, because I happen to think jail's an important part of local control. The other last thing I wanted to, final remark I wanted to make was just to remind the legislature that one of the paramount purposes of sentencing guidelines was to allow the legislature to have to create some structure around sentencing that could control the demand on state prison beds. That was one of the paramount reasons for sentencing guidelines. We all know that that's been significantly affected by mandatory minimum sentences, and I would say it's been significantly affected by Miller-Buchholz, and this is your chance to fix it and return control to the legislature.
Any other questions or comments for our panel?
You can have my pen if you want. Not sure.
Apparently not.
Thanks.
We really appreciate you all being here this evening to share your thoughts on this. Thank you very much. Well, committee, that is the business we had on the agenda. I'll solicit any final comments or concerns, questions before we adjourn. Everybody's ready to go.
We're ready.
Except for Friday.
Yeah, so I'm going to close the informational meeting. And so we have our next meeting scheduled for Friday at 1 o'clock? 1 o'clock Friday for further possible action on this amendment. So our committee's adjourned. Thank you.
You're,